Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. This is the summertime edition, but we have a serious, mostly serious topic today because it also involves the movies. Attorney Robert Belot from the Taft Law Firm, who the movie Dark Waters was based on, and all of the chemical lawsuits against DuPont. And he's been doing this work for years, not just that one case. He's still doing it today. And, you know, after East Palestine, I thought I would like to talk to him, kind of hear what he has to say about things today. And this, that happened on February 3rd. This is the soonest we could book him. He's one of the foremost experts in this country. He works, he travels, he goes, he speaks on behalf of people's health. And so I'm very excited to have him today, a serious summer topic.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Sherry, because people might be thinking, okay, it was a while back when the train derailed in East Palestine. And we thought, you know, as we were looking at guests to book for the podcast, Rob Belot would be a perfect guest to talk about the danger of what he calls forever chemicals, and the, you know, the situation in East Palestine kind of brought it back into people's minds again, the dangers of all these chemicals, you know, known and unknown in our lives. And you're right, he's a busy guy with all the work he's doing. And I can't wait to ask him about how, you know, an attorney based in Cincinnati found himself at the forefront of, you know, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, class action lawsuits and settlements against a company, and that would be DuPont. So we're going to get into all of that, but we've got some news breaking as we speak, as we record. You know, maybe some people thought that the new guard of the Cincinnati City Council would be free and clear of, you know, any of the issues that dogged the previous council when it came to, you know, ethics and playing it straight by the book. But we had a little situation pop up. Can you fill us in?
We did. This is something that I've known about for about a month that was kind of swirling around City Hall, but it wasn't really something that was gettable. Councilman Seth Walsh, he's our newest council member. He was appointed to replace Greg Landsman when Greg Landsman was elected to Congress. So he took office in December. He definitely was chosen in December. So he's...
And former podcast guest.
Yes, yes. And someone I've known a long time through his work in College Hill. He had an issue with one of his City Hall staffers who did not like what she perceived as a lot of ethics violations related to how the campaign, it's a council election year, you guys, how the campaign was going compared to like the overlap with the city staff, which in principle, there should be none. The lines are a little blurry, but she was like, this way crossed the line. She wrote, and this is, it all comes to light. She wrote a talking points memo to herself and she left it on the printer. And it set in motion a lot of things, including the fact that he did fire her. Now, he did say he fired her for poor performance, and she doesn't agree with that. And she got a $30,000 settlement from the city after she, you know, honestly, I wouldn't even say how she started was like making a complaint. I think she just started with asking questions of like, well, what happened here? What are the rules? What could happen? And it set in motion some investigations. This investigation is still going on now. The settlement happened. They wanted to avoid some litigation. She had, you know, words she used, ethics violations. She was fearful about some things, retaliation, and they gave her $30,000 for that. But there's still an investigation.
So probably more to come on this, but just, you know, to give you a well-deserved pat on the back. Your story establishes clearly the timeline. You know, at this point, you have an employee who's been fired. You have the boss, in this case, Councilmember Walsh, who's saying it's for performance. But the timeline shows that the termination happened 2 days after that memo, a list of her concerns, was found by him. And, you know, again, she is not a elected official. She's not appointed. She's actually, you know, hired by the council member. So it's a little bit different. But where it becomes really a matter of public interest, I think, for sure and clearly, is that the city paid $30,000 to settle with her. So, I mean, that's taxpayer money. That kind of shows that that was the path of least resistance, because perhaps, you know, she had a strong case, or at least her allegations were such that, you know, a settlement is definitely not an admission of guilt. Sometimes it's just an acknowledgement that this is a more economic way to settle, you know, to avoid, you know, a full-blown lawsuit or, you know, ongoing attorney's fees and all that. But it definitely shows that there's a there. So what do you think is going to happen next?
So it broke. A lot of everyone in City Hall, of course, has been talking about this and knew that the staffer had been fired. There wasn't any paper trail of anything really until the settlement paperwork was released by the city. And that's kind of what the story is predicated on now. But, you know, the city is in the middle of the budget. And by the middle of the budget, it's honestly the beginning of the budget. Like there's been two budget presentations, one to the public in a press conference and one to the actual budget committee, which is all 9 council members. But they are in a very serious moment of really hashing out this budget and trying to get the things done that they need to get done. And I just think on Monday, there's a budget hearing on Monday, you guys. There's a budget committee meeting. We'll be there. We're going to learn a lot about Aftab Pirovol's his hopes and dreams for the budget. You'll see a story Monday morning that'll be online about financial freedom. And so I think that people are not walking into City Hall on Monday being like, hey, let's talk about this budget motion. They're going to be talking about this.
And just for the context, which I alluded to, you know, the previous iteration of City Council, of course, was marked by, you know, all kinds of controversy around pay for play. You had 3 members of City Council indicted. Jeff Pastor just agreed to sign a plea deal admitting guilt for, you know, seeking compensation for favorable votes or whatever he could provide in his position of power. You know, so you had, you know, the new election, you had the new council members, you have a new mayor who boldly said, look, this is not going to be a council full of controversy. These are dedicated public servants. And, you know, once again, and again, probably not as serious as the, you know, the racketeering charges or the corruption charges. I shouldn't say racketeering, the corruption charges. But an ethics violation nonetheless, where you have an employee saying this member of council, his staff is mixing up 2 things that shouldn't be mixed. And one of that is, you know, campaigning, seeking reelection should be done outside of the office of the council member. You know, those employees should be focused on supporting the council member for policy and, you know, official activities in the capacity of an elected official, but not for campaigning. So the accusation is that those were mixed up in this case. And so, what do you think the mayor's response will be to this when he wants to have, you know, his council, his administration, you know, for being squeaky clean and devoid of any of those types of ethical situations?
How about I don't say what I think the mayor is going to do, but I do say how I think this story is going to go.
All right, fair enough.
The mayor's been out of town this week. He was on vacation. He's going to come back, and the budget is with some very serious discussions over 2 weeks. The investigation is ongoing, and that means there's going to be more stories to come. The staffer herself has not spoken yet. She could speak. Then we're going to follow it up with the Democratic Party, which is getting ready to endorse a slate of who will mostly be your next council candidates, probably the same ones you have now. It's really, that's going to be a lot of what I write about this summer. is getting ready to endorse. Now, they actually canceled their endorsement hearing right after this happened because people were on, and I know you guys can't see me, but air quotes, on vacation, because this, I think they were like, what are we going to do about this? Because you would automatically think there's 8 Democrats, they'll all get endorsed, and then they're going to be looking for a 9th Democrat to endorse because there is a Republican on city council, Liz Keating, she's running again. And so then we're going to have the endorsement process, which we would automatically cover. But the fact that it is, does a sitting council member get the endorsement or not get the endorsement? Definitely news. Who gets it over him? These two people, then if he did not get the endorsement from them, it becomes story. Then the investigation comes out, story after story. And I don't think that's something this city hall is looking for right now.
I would agree. I doubt we'll hear from the employee. Usually with a settlement comes a NDA.
Burl, you never know. You never know.
All right, let's make a bet right here. I bet that there's an ND, a non-disclosure agreement as part of the settlement.
Actually,
we won't be hearing from her. That's my bet.
There's not.
There's not.
I agree. We probably won't be hearing from her. A lot of her stuff was aired already in this, and she honestly made a nod to it. And like, I'm not a disgruntled employee. I don't want to really like, you know, say all this publicly and da da da. But of course, with public records and everything, the city did release a lot of, and it's how we got the story through the public records. These communications and emails and everything. I'm with you. She probably doesn't want to, but you don't know. Maybe.
We can always.
And so I will say, I mean, I've heard a lot today, people really praising her for having the courage, even the way that this was not necessarily she's coming forward and saying something, like having the courage to say something about this and understanding that this isn't how it should be. So I've heard a lot of praise for her today.
All right. Well, on that note, let's jump over to our special guest.
Special guest time here. And today I have somebody who's super busy with us, but I'm very excited to have on. We have on attorney Rob Blatt. Many of you might already know his name because he was made famous in a movie filmed in Cincinnati called Dark Waters. Attorney Blatt is one of the foremost experts on chemicals in the United States and the litigation related to them. And I think we're going to dig in and we're going to learn a lot today.
Glad to be here.
So, you know, I didn't say that you're at the firm. You're at Taft Law Firm downtown. How long have you been there?
Yeah, I started at Taft, in Cincinnati back 32 years ago, 1990. So I've been working out of the Cincinnati office and the Northern Kentucky office.
Has the Cincinnati office changed at all in that time?
You know, it's changed a lot. It's grown a lot. The firm has grown. We're now over 800 attorneys in various cities across the country. So it's been a lot of change over the last couple decades.
So let's start. We like to get to know our guests and like a little bit about their lives. I mean, you are, it's, since you live in Northern Kentucky now, but like Cincinnati and Ohioan, you know, did you, when you kind of set out on a career in law, think that this is the direction your career would take?
Yeah, absolutely not. When I grew up outside, primarily outside of Dayton. My dad was in the Air Force. We were stationed up at Wright-Patt, just up the road here, and then went to Ohio State and then started my legal career here in Cincinnati with Taft back in 1990. And, you know, a lot of what I was doing when I first started out was really sort of learning this whole world of environmental law. Taft had a big environmental group, and a lot of what we were doing was helping big companies. Navigate the world of environmental law, what kinds of things can go out into the air, into the water, into the land, and had been doing that for about 8 years and was becoming partner at the firm and thought, you know, that was sort of my career path seemed pretty clear. And it all changed in 1998 when I got a call from a farmer in West Virginia wanting me to help him figure out what was happening to his cows. And that led me into an area of unregulated chemicals that I've been trying to navigate now for the last almost 25 years of my career.
And it seems like from my reading before this, that there are a lot of unregulated chemicals, which is hard to imagine in today's world that it still could be happening with how much we know. But we'll kind of get into that a little bit later. So, I mean, was Taft kind of new to, like, were other firms taking on environmental cases, or did Taft kind of, it seems like that was the early days of environmental law, period.
Yeah, the US EPA came into existence in 1970. And a lot of the first federal laws governing the environmental issues started to roll out in the 1970s, and some of them in the late 70s, early 80s. And Taft actually formed an environmental group early on in the early 1980s to help clients figure out what was going on with all of that. So by the time I joined the firm in 1990, we had a pretty well-established group that was working on environmental issues across the country, and other law firms had environmental practices by that point as well. But it was definitely something that had really started up in the 80s, really.
And of course, you take on this big case in 1998 against DuPont, and you're really on behalf of citizens. And this has become like a big thing in law now, that of what's going on with the chemicals. And so can you kind of tell us about that, like the whole dark water story?
Yeah, you know, again, most of what I was doing up to that point in time was working with a lot of our big corporate clients, including a lot of big chemical companies. But when this farmer called me in 1998 asking for help with his cows, you know, that's not the kind of thing that I was normally doing or that our firm did. But, you know, when we listened to what was happening and this farmer explained what he and his family were dealing with, and it wasn't just his cows getting sick, but he himself and his wife and his children possibly getting sick, and listening, you know, to this gentleman really needing our help, we decided this is something we could do. We could help him. You know, this is the kind of thing that we did. We worked with companies on these issues, and we thought we could help him as well. So we took that case on in early 1998, and at the time, really kind of thought, you know, this was a fairly narrow case. This was one family. It was a small farm in West Virginia. It'd be pretty simple issue to help them resolve what was going on. We had no idea that what we ended up discovering was that there was a chemical that not only was getting into the water these cows were drinking, and that this family in West Virginia was drinking, but this chemical, it turned out, was in the drinking water of the entire surrounding community, tens of thousands of people. And then eventually we realized this chemical was part of an entire family of completely unregulated chemicals that were in the drinking water all over the planet and getting into our soil, getting into wildlife, getting into animals, and getting into people. 99% of the humans on the planet were being contaminated. So what began as what we thought was a fairly small, straightforward case for one family, we eventually discovered we had uncovered something that could be impacting the entire globe.
A $670.7 million settlement at the end there for the class action case?
Well, yeah, you know, we eventually were able to resolve a class action we brought on behalf of that community around the farmer's property in West Virginia. We settled that for over $300 million in benefits. And then once we were able to confirm with independent scientists that this chemical was in fact linked with causing serious diseases, including cancers, we ended up being able to resolve thousands of individual injury cases, people who had cancer and other diseases from drinking this in the water. We settled that in 2017. Thousands of those cases are about 670 million. And then in 2021, dozens more cases for another 83 million. So to date, it's about 753 million just in that one community. And then unfortunately, what we've found out, this same chemical, as I mentioned, not only is it in the drinking water all over the country, it's been used in all kinds of products, including things like firefighting foam, the type of foam you use to combat gasoline or petroleum-based fires, used outside of airports, fire stations, military bases, all over the country. And what we're now representing states and water providers and others all over the country that are dealing with the costs of having to clean these chemicals up from getting in there from firefighting foam that was sprayed out onto the ground. That's how people were told to use it. And unfortunately, the companies that were making these chemicals weren't telling anybody that this stuff was in the firefighting foam or to be careful when you spray it out there. So you've got this stuff all over the country and all over the drinking water. So we're handling litigation all over the U.S. now to try to make sure that the costs of cleaning that up out of our water, that that's not borne by the victims here. All of us who didn't know this was in the water and are just now finding this out. And actually just today, we were able to announce a settlement with DuPont and its related companies for over $1 billion to resolve just the drinking water claims across the country. So we're continuing to try to make sure that the companies who did this, and did this knowing, unfortunately, what we found out over decades, is the companies making these chemicals knew they were dangerous, knew they would get into water, knew they would get into people's blood decades ago, but kept doing this anyway. So what we're trying to do is make sure that those are the companies, those are the people who pay the cost that we're now all facing to clean this up nationwide, now, frankly, worldwide.
Congratulations. Like a $1 billion settlement. I mean, I covered courts long enough to know that that's not an everyday settlement, that that's not like, oh, it's 2023. That's the kind of number that comes through. And that is how many plaintiffs are in that case?
Well, that's just the DuPont related companies. And that's just for public water providers. It's just a settlement in principle that's been announced. A lot of details to be worked out and all of that. But that's for public water providers. And there are unfortunately a lot of them across the country, including here in this area, you know, that have discovered these chemicals getting into our drinking water and are now having to deal with the costs of testing and sampling and filtration systems. So it's important to make sure that the people who caused the problem are responsible, not the victims of the problem.
And the scope of the problem, I've read you quoted as saying over the last 20 years that these chemicals have contributed to approximately 6 million deaths, you know, compared to the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, this is a health crisis of a higher magnitude, yet it's not something I think that the general public views as a health crisis. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, you know, it's really kind of disturbing when you step back and look at this. I don't think we've ever dealt with contamination of a scope and scale and severity of what we're dealing with right now with these chemicals. And, you know, I keep referring to these chemicals. What we're talking about are completely man-made chemicals that never existed on the planet prior to World War II, invented by 3M companies, started making these right around the time of the war, and others like DuPont jumped in and started making these things, all characterized by taking carbons and attaching them to fluorine, which makes this really strong chemical bond, makes them useful in lots of different products. And these chemicals have been used to make all kinds of things over the last 70, 80 years. Anything, you know, that you see that's stain resistant, waterproof, grease resistant, you know, stuff like fast food wrappers and packaging, carpeting, clothing, computer chips, firefighting foam, just all these different products. But not only does it that chemical bond make them useful, it makes it very difficult to break apart. So when it gets out into the environment, it stays there. It stays in the water. It stays in people. That's why you hear them referred to now as forever chemicals. And most disturbingly, what we've found out is these chemicals also are incredibly toxic. They have been linked with a number of different potential human impacts, including cancers, testicular cancer, for example, kidney cancer. And more recent data is showing that they have the ability to impact our immune system, possibly even decrease the effectiveness of vaccines. You know, here are chemicals that are in our water, that are in our blood, that could be having these kinds of impacts. That's why you're seeing regulatory agencies, local, state, national, now international, being incredibly concerned and setting increasingly stringent guidelines for how much of this is allowed. Because what we're seeing, these chemicals get into the body and they're worldwide and they could have all kinds of potential health impacts. And as you mentioned, there was a recent paper that was published looking at, you know, how many deaths and serious illness could be attributed to these chemicals. And they estimated some 6 million deaths in the US just since 1999, potentially linked to these chemicals. Other recent papers that are trying to look at what are the potential costs to society from these chemicals. And you see calculations of tens of billions in potential healthcare costs. Because again, these chemicals are pretty much all over the place. They're getting into almost all of us and they're being shown to have effects at very low levels. So that's why you're seeing so much increasing concern. But if you step back and ask the public, what's PFAS? Have you ever heard of perfluorooctanoic acid? Most people are going to have no idea what you're talking about because these are chemicals, not only can you not pronounce them, you know, most people have never heard of them. They have no idea what they are. And even though the companies making them have known about them for so long, the general public is only just now becoming aware that they exist, where they've been used. Things like the movie Dark Waters, or there's a documentary, The Devil We Know, you know, things that have finally started to get that story out. People are only just now becoming aware of this. And I think a part of that problem, when you say PFAS or perfluorooctanoic acid, it doesn't resonate with people like lead, arsenic, you know, things that people immediately understand. Because again, most people just haven't heard of this. And that's why, to me, it's incredibly important to be discussing these issues and have like what we're doing here, to make sure that people understand these things are out there, that they exist, and so that people can start taking steps to protect themselves. Because, you know, this has been a major public health threat that has really gone unrecognized for decades and is only just now really starting to emerge. And, you know, when we see the President of the United States now discussing the fact that we have a national PFAS problem, you know, something I thought I'd never see happen. But I think that's a reflection of the fact that that story is finally making its way out to the public.
I do have to say, I think I agree that the public is becoming more aware. I've written 3 stories about water over the last year and a half, like, because I cover the city and I don't, you know, there's a lot of things to cover in the city. It's not always just the water department. But those stories have done amazingly well and also provided a lot of feedback, which you don't always get, like tons of feedback on like the city budget or whatever, but you do. I did hear from so many people who were just like, thank you for talking about our water and letting us know, because just you expect to turn on the faucet and you expect it to be safe, but that is not the case.
Well, you know, I think you've got folks here locally that are doing a fantastic job in making sure, you know, that our water is addressed appropriately. And again, you know, the concern is, you know, if we're going to have to start dealing with these chemicals and start incurring the costs of dealing or, you know, doing additional things, it's clear who ought to be paying for that. You know, it's the companies who created this stuff and didn't tell all of us. So, you know, unfortunately, there's areas of the country where, you know, you don't have treatment systems in place, or, you know, there really hasn't been much done to address the water up until now. And you know, it's concerning, you know, that when people find out this has been happening.
What kind of an impact did the movie have in terms of the public having a better comprehension of the problem? And also, how did your life change once Dark Waters launched in theaters?
You know, at first I was a little hesitant about being involved in, you know, a movie that was all new to me. But, you know, when Mark Ruffalo reached out after reading an article in the New York Times Magazine about all of this back in 2016, you know, and he started explaining to me that, look, you know, he had been involved in water issues and considered himself, you know, educated on what was going on in the water world. And he had never heard of this stuff. And why, how is that possible? How, you know, how could we make sure that the rest of the country and the world understood what was happening, and really led to the idea of doing this feature film, Dark Waters? And also doing it for the right reason, you know, making sure that we stuck to the facts, that we showed what was really happening here, and that it was done in a way that people understood why this was important and why, you know, this story mattered. And it wasn't just about one family in West Virginia. This was a bigger story that impacted all of us. I think they did a great job, you know, taking what in essence was over 20 years of a story with a lot of complicated science and law, and putting it together in a way that really shows you, you know, the essence of what was going on and what impact that had on real people. And I think it's had a tremendous impact. You know, the after screenings and folks like policymakers, lawmakers have had a chance to see it. I think it's had a real ability to help people understand that this is a real problem and that something that needs to be addressed. And we've seen dramatic change since that film came out in late 2019. Laws are being proposed, regulations are being proposed, steps are being taken for the first time to actually start restricting these chemicals and to take steps to make sure that they don't continue to be pumped out into our environment or into our water. You know, things that weren't happening before that film came out. You know, and Mark Ruffalo and folks who were involved in the film have continued. You know, they didn't just stop after the movie came out in 2019. They've continued to participate in town hall meetings and you know, even meetings with Congress, testimony in front of the U.S. Congress to try to make sure people who are making decisions about this have all the information they need. So I think it's had a huge impact. And, you know, I just can't thank them enough for the work that they did.
So this is a very important and serious topic. But I want to veer just briefly to something I think our listeners might be fascinated with too, because not all of us have had the experience of an A-list Hollywood actor. I mean, he's an Avenger, for God's sakes. He plays the Hulk. To take an interest in our lives and then portray us on the big screen. What was that experience like? And what was it like when you saw the movie for the first time, seeing someone portray yourself?
Yeah, that was pretty surreal. You know, to have Mark Ruffalo and Anne Hathaway at our house with my kids, you know, going out to dinner and, you know, spending so much time. They were fantastic. And, you know, they really wanted to understand, you know, what was going on within our family. And I think they did a terrific job of that. But the whole experience was completely surreal. I mean, I was fortunate that almost all of it was filmed here in Cincinnati, a lot of it in our law offices at Taft. So we got to watch the filming. I got to consult on the script to make sure things were accurate and, you know, to really see how all of that was done. You know, and then we got to watch it. My family and I, we got to see the film for the first time up at the Esquire and then Clifton, where we had a private screening, got to watch the film. And, it was tremendous, to see all of that actually on screen still something hard to fathom.
Do your friends and family members feel that Mark captured you?
Well, you know, when I was first watching the movie, I'm thinking, oh, I don't do that. I don't. And then I remember one of my sons, during the initial screening, turned around and just said, he nailed you. He got you down perfectly. So I figured, okay.
Our kids know us the best. Our kids know us the best.
Yeah, so I think he did a great job. Yeah.
Also, I'm looking at you. I'm like twins. You two are twins.
Thank you.
You talked about consulting. Were there times when you had to push back on how they were trying to capture it for the screenplay? Were there times where they might have been off the mark or over-dramatized a bit and you pushed back? Did you feel like you had a strong say in the outcome of the movie?
Yeah, they were always listening to my input, which was fantastic. You know, great director Todd Haynes, you know, who had been here before filming the movie Carol in Cincinnati, you know, fantastic guy. And yeah, there was one scene, for example, where I'm taking the deposition of the CEO of DuPont, which, you know, was an actual thing that happened. And I think maybe they would have liked to have done that scene a little more what we call Hollywood, you know, a little more anger and shouting. And I had to explain
with you
to them,
pounding your fist on the table, I want the truth, that kind of. Yeah,
that's right. So I had to explain, no, you know, this was done for this particular purpose. This is the way we did it. And they listened, and that was, they ended up doing the scene that way. So I have to give them incredible credit for doing that. Because again, their goal was to make sure that it accurately portrayed the way things really, really transpired.
My favorite thing as a reporter was all of the documents, the boxes of documents that has happened to me. And it's like, did I ask for those? Because then you got to go through them one by one. You don't know what's in them. It could be the one piece of paper in the middle of thousands that is the thing that is interesting that you need that tells the whole story. And it's like, you got to read it all.
Exactly. You know, and these were the days before everything started being put on computers. This was the late 90s when we still had the chance as lawyers, when we were in litigation, to see the other side's actual documents, their actual paper files. And I tell folks now, you know, when I speak with law students or law schools, that this case would not have happened if it had started today, because now the rules have changed. And when you sit down and file a case, for example, the lawyer bringing the case has to sit down with the other side and upfront give them a list of all of the search terms that they have to search their computer for. And then they only give you those documents. Well, think about in this case, when I started off, I had no idea what chemical was involved. I had no idea that they referred to it five different ways and it had five different names. I would never have had those terms to give them to search. So we never probably would have gotten the documents. So, you know, it's a lot of work, but there's a lot to be said for going through the actual paper and taking the time to read the paper.
That's absolutely.
From an investigative reporter standpoint, do you have the paper? And you're absolutely right. In the modern era of records requests, if we're making Freedom of Information Act requests, for example, because it's all digital, we get pushback, and judges and courts have sided, you know, with state agencies and governments. We get pushback for overly broad requests just because, you know, we're in this world of data. As you know, and we are forced to narrow the search term, asking for specific dates, asking for specific names. And it does make the job of an investigative reporter, and in your case, someone who's trying to build a case, much more difficult instead of making it easier. It's one of those paradoxes, I think.
Yeah, you know, it works if you know what you're looking for and you know the names of the things you're looking for. It doesn't work if you are investigating and you're trying to actually learn what the names of these things are or what, you know, so you, it's almost as if you have to know the answers before you start now. So a lot of what we were able to do in the past, you're simply not able to do anymore.
I did want to, we are running a little bit out of time. I feel like you have other big cases to get to. I did want to ask you, I mean, I was really prompted to watch Dark Waters after the East Palestine. My hometown is very near where that happened. And I wanted to ask you, like, what you thought when you saw that and what you think now about what's happening.
You know, it was a tragic situation where, once again, I think it really highlighted for people how dependent we are on transparency of information and being able to access information about what we're being exposed to. And as you said earlier, you know, I think a lot of folks, particularly in the United States, we just assume, hey, if we're being exposed to something dangerous, there's somebody out there that's going to tell us that or alert us to that. And unfortunately, what we see in cases like what we've been talking about with DuPont and these forever chemicals or in East Palestine, that's not always the case. You know, that a lot of times we, the exposed people, have to take it upon ourselves to make sure we understand what we're being exposed to and to demand the information. And we can't just assume, you know, that we're going to be told if there's a problem.
Did alarm bells go off for you, like big ones of like what was going to happen after this? And were you able to kind of like understand what it was going to mean for the weeks to come?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we've seen situations like that before. And, you know, again, I think what you saw there were a lot of concern by people who wanted information, just wanted to know not only what have we been exposed to, but what are the long-term effects? You know, that's a critical issue, for example, as we've been dealing with these forever chemicals, where, you know, a lot of the information about what impact these chemicals would have, that was covered up by the companies making them. Even though they knew, you know, that these chemicals could cause all kinds of problems, they covered it up for decades and then actively misled the government and the regulators and the public for decades about it. So I think, you know, it's a recurring concern, you know, of how do we make sure that we have an accurate access to information about chemicals that we're exposed to and what they can do to us.
It is amazing to me that so many times don't want to say, because to me, like as a reporter, I was like, just because you don't have to say what's on the trains doesn't mean you can't. You could, and just tell and let local firefighters, we have so many trains coming through here. I'm just like, just so they know and they can be prepared for what's coming through. And this, we don't have to. The government says we don't have to.
Well, you know, it's frustrating because a lot of times you don't know whether the information, you know, that's been provided as far as what chemicals are there is complete. And then you don't necessarily have full information about what those chemicals can do. You may have information about what they might do in an immediate sense, you know, but what's the long-term potential effects? And, you know, I think most of the public doesn't necessarily realize that you've got different standards. The government approaches those questions very differently. You know, what's allowable for an immediate exposure versus what might present harm over the long term? Those could be two very different answers. And so it's complicated. And again, it just highlights how important it is for the information to be transparent and to be as complete as possible.
So I know we're up against time, but I wanted to ask you what the average person should know about forever chemicals. And maybe in the terms of, you know, have your personal habits along this journey, have they changed or have, you know, do you still drink out of a tap? Have you switched to bottled water? What is the takeaway for the average person and what do they most need to know about the situation with forever chemicals?
Yeah, great, great point. And I think what I try to tell folks is the most important thing is to be aware that these exist. Be aware that there's this class of chemicals and the types of products they've been used in over the in the past. And you know what? It's not easy to find out which products these chemicals were used in, because the chemicals haven't been regulated, so they haven't necessarily been on warning labels or ingredient labels. So finding out where you've been exposed to these, what products, is not easy. But you can look for sort of certain types of materials like stain resistant, waterproof, nonstick, grease resistant. Because we found out these chemicals can be in, you know, things like cosmetics or clothing, and you know, where every day you're seeing articles popping up online about these chemicals, you know, being found in contact lenses and toilet paper. And so it can be overwhelming. But as long as you're aware they exist, you're aware of the types of properties they have, this waterproof, stain resistant, slipperiness, you can start making choices. And you can, most importantly, start making your voice be heard to the companies that are still making these products and let them know, we don't want these out there anymore. And believe it or not, that's actually happening now. You see consumers all over the world that are reaching out to companies saying, we don't want these chemicals in our carpets. We don't want them in our clothing. We don't want them in our fast food wrappers or packaging. And major companies, big fast food companies, clothing companies, carpet retailers are voluntarily coming forward even before the laws change. And they are taking the chemicals out and they're creating products without these. And so it's important to just let your voice be heard. That you don't want to be exposed to these, because it really does make a difference. The companies are responding. They're seeing a market that is now existing because people don't want these anymore. And that's going to have a huge impact, because that's going to get these out of our environment. We're not going to have more and more of these coming out of new products. But again, you know, it's almost impossible to try to avoid these because you just don't know every product. But you can start making choices and making your voice be heard.
I agree. We vote with our wallets. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a really good chat. And thank you for all the work that you do in informing us today.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with all of you.
All right. Well, we want to thank again our special guest, Rob. And it got me thinking, Sherry. So as we were talking with him about who played him in Dark Waters, Mark Ruffalo, who would you want to play you in a movie?
You know, that thought like passed through my head. And of course, Anne Hathaway was in that movie. I love her. But these days I don't have dark hair anymore to cover up all my gray. I'm blonde. So it's kind of like I have to kind of think it through of like, who might it be? And also I have to remember I'm 50, not young.
Well, yeah, that's kind of where I was going with this. You know, I never really thought about who would play me, but one time I was walking down the street with some friends and I was a little younger, a lot less grayer. And there were some kids hanging on the street corner. And, you know, they looked at me as we were walking by and we made eye contact and we kind of did that nod like, what's up, hello, and everything like that. And when we were about 10 feet away, one of them yelled out, yo, Antonio Banderas. And my friends cracked up, were rolling on the ground laughing. And, you know, I don't see the resemblance, especially now, but so that became the ongoing joke, Antonio Banderas. So if I ever made it famous, and we're aging together, you know, I think we're roughly the same age. He hasn't been in too many movies lately, but if there was ever, you know, Burl of the movie and I had anything to say about it, that's where I would start.
I have to say, I don't know if you can say this about your boss or and your podcast co-host, but I will anyway. I feel like that you could be an extra in any of these movies that film in Cincinnati. And at the end credits, it would be like, cool dude. Like to know you is to know you dress
totally
cool.
Up.
You seem much younger than you are. And I feel like that's the credits right there. Cool dude.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, you have witnessed the perfection in suck uppery. I've never seen anyone do it so well as Sherry. So, well, you know, maybe on that note, Sherry, we should just wrap it up. I'm going to go out on a high.
Okay.
You know, you made my day. All right. Thanks, everybody.